Welcome to Field Notes, a podcast hosted by the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. With each new episode, we'll spotlight the amazing work that's happening across Georgia's educational landscape through local, community-driven initiatives. Because a better future for Georgia begins with education, business, and elected leaders collaborating together. So let's just dig right into this episode. Now here's your host, Kathleen DeSilva.
Well, welcome to Field Notes by Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education, where we believe a better future for Georgians start with education. For those wondering who this new voice is, my name is Kat. I'm the new Regional Engagement Manager and your new Field Notes host. If you have not checked out my introduction episode, do so. It is titled Welcome, Kat. On today's episode, the intersection of medicine and literacy, we are honored to have with us the amazing Dr. Keisha Callens. Let me first congratulate Dr. Callens on receiving the inaugural Sandra Dale Dugan Service Fellow Award. Congratulations. The award recognizes your significant contribution to mentoring, inspiring, and encouraging medical students to care for Georgians in rural underserved areas. That is so amazing. Super, super honored to have you with us today. I was reading through the article on your award, and I will say one thing that jumped out to me is the quote from Alicia May, fourth year rising medical student. And she said, knowing her impact on the students and on her patients in rural areas encourages me to have the same qualities. I believe she is a wonderful example and is so deserving of this award. Absolutely. I could not have said it better. And y'all, again, let's welcome Dr. Keisha Callens, physician, public health leader, and advocate for rural underserved patients. So welcome, Dr. Callens.
Thank you. Thank you for that awesome introduction. I am so honored and so excited to have a chance to speak with you this morning on a really interesting topic. So thank you so much for having me. And welcome to your new opportunity.
Thank you. First interview on the podcast. And I am just super, super excited to have you and super excited to have this interview with you. And I did want to share a little bit more just about the boards you serve on and the work that you do and fill in with anything that I am missing. But appointed by Governor Deal to the Georgia Medical Board in 2014 and the Sandra Deal Early Language and Literacy Board, you also currently serve on the Board of Directors for Healthcare, Georgia Foundation, Georgia State Medical Association, and Georgia Task Force on Physician Healthcare Workforce Resilience. Did I get those right?
Yeah. You did. Thank you.
Currently providing gynecology services and at Macon Volunteer Clinic and residents of Brookdale. Is it Brookdale?
Yes.
Resource Center.
Yep. So that's one of my things that I do in terms of community service. The Macon Volunteer Clinic is one of our facilities here that provides care to patients in both Bibb and Twix County that do not have health insurance. And so that's a supportive part of what we do. But my main employment is with community healthcare systems, which is a federally qualified health center network that serves Central Georgia. So we have 18 clinics throughout Central Georgia and a lot of our rural communities. And I serve specifically on site in Jones County as well as Twiggs County, which are two of our rural communities. And then, of course, provide support and consultation services for other offices as well. So, get a great opportunity to serve lots of rural communities in Central Georgia.
That is super, super awesome. And I'd love to hear more about just how you got started. What was the journey like? What brought you to rural Georgia?
So it depends on how far back we want to go. So in full disclosure, I am originally from Jamaica, actually Montego Bay. And my mom says that I always expressed an interest in medicine as early as age 6. And so kind of had that interest very early. And once I finished high school, because I wanted to pursue medicine, my parents encouraged me to move to the United States so that I could pursue that through college and then hopefully medical school. And so actually left home pretty early at 16 and stayed with family friends and was able to go to university. I went to University of Virginia and then actually applied to medical school and did not get in the first time, which was quite devastating. That turn or detour, so to speak, actually led me into public health where I got my master's degree. And then through very amazing mentorship of many people, including my mother-in-law and the support of my parents and my father-in-law as well, decided to pursue medicine again and then got into Morehouse School of Medicine and kind of the rest is history. And so, you know, ended up training at Morehouse School of Medicine for medical school and then also residency training for obstetrics and gynecology. But I always wanted to do underserved populations. And as a National Health Service course scholar, once I completed my residency training, needed to complete my service commitment in a rural community. And so that kind of launched me into rural practice. I spent the first probably 6 years in Albany, Georgia, Southwest Georgia, and then later transitioned to Central Georgia. So now that's where I'm residing. And so that's kind of the trajectory for how that's been going. But absolutely love working in our underserved communities, in our rural communities in Georgia.
Awesome. And you stated it was something in your residency that started you off in rural Georgia and Albany?
Well, I think because of the National Health Service Corps, you do have to complete your service in an underserved community. So based on the levels of need, and so that is actually a requirement for the scholarship opportunity is to really get more healthcare providers to work in rural communities. And so that was kind of the move that kind of launched me into that. And then just really enjoy that opportunity, not just for service, but also for teaching opportunities too. It works well in terms of being able to recruit and mentor, upcoming health professionals to really consider working in rural communities. And so it kind of has a dual benefit, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Once you said that, I was super curious about that. I thought that was just a great program to support rural and underserved communities and also introduce new young professionals to those areas as well. So that is really, really awesome. And great to hear that you completed the program and found a place home in a rural community as well. So as a kid, you knew you wanted to be a doctor. I think we spoke another time and you said your mom told you she knew because of your messy handwriting.
Definitely. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy. My handwriting is absolutely terrible. And so I guess maybe I was destined to do that, which is interesting because, when I didn't hit the mark the first time, I really was very disappointed, but also did not want to disappoint my parents. Yeah. And so it was interesting. I thought I was going to walk away from it and I tried to, and then I just couldn't do it. And so it's interesting sometimes how when you have a passion for something, it won't let you go. And that's a good thing because you can kind of find your way back to it. And so I love that part of my life experience, especially when I'm communicating with students who, don't have a paved road to their medical journey. They probably have, an unpaved pathway. And so I can say, hey, I kind of had a similar thing. And I think that's very encouraging to share that you can have speed bumps and you can still make it and you can have detours and you can still get there. And so that experience, I think, is valuable for anyone that's thinking about pursuing medicine or get stuck in the mud along the way. That's part of the process. And there's value in that too, not just for you as you advance in your career, but us also, helps you to be relatable to your patients, because a lot of the patients that you encounter are going to have challenges. And so your own ability to overcome and the resilience that you developed is something that you can also impart on patients when they are facing difficult medical challenges as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think we all want that paved road. And some of us, some people get to get it. But there is just beauty and so much growth and learning that comes when we when it's unpaved, and we might kind of go off track a little bit, come back on. And when you look back, it's what you learned when you were off track that really kind of makes that specialness to what you do too. So absolutely. I love, love, love that. A statistic that I was reading that I also thought was really great was that 60% of Mercer University School of Medicine graduates practice in Georgia, and 80% of the 60 graduates practice in rural Georgia or medically undeserved communities. And those numbers just jumped out to me to be able to grow and keep medical professionals in Georgia, and 80% in rural Georgia as well. How amazing. And you are a testament to that, staying here with Georgians and supporting those communities. Thank you.
Well, I think that it really is speaks to their embodiment of the mission of the medical school, which is to do exactly that, is to make sure that we have physicians taking care of rural underserved communities. And so that statement is not just a statement. There's action to that. There have been significant changes in the recruitment of medical students from rural communities with the thought that they will return to their communities and practice. And so there are a lot of factors that impact where people do their training or do their practice, but we have figured out that, you know, at least half of the people who are going to serve probably in those communities are going to come there. They're going to want to go back home and take care of their families and their friends. And so that is a huge contributing factor to the recruitment process. And then so it kind of sets up that success pathway. And, you know, it takes a really long time to grow a doctor, right? I mean, think about 4 years of college.
Yep.
4 years of med school, and then whatever residency training, you know, for OB, it's 4 years. For other primary care specialties, it's 3 years. And for, you know, surgery, it may be, you know, it's usually 7 years or longer. So really, it takes a long time to grow a doctor. And so it really is the ultimate investment. And I tell my students all the time, you are my retirement. You know, they are like, oh, thank you for helping me. And I'm like, no, I have ulterior motives. You know, it's not just that, but I really want them to have an opportunity, and being able to practice in a rural community and as a faculty member for the medical school, having students to be able to come and see how it looks to have roots in a community, to engage the community, to really be a part of, you know, meetings at the school system or whatever economic development projects are going on. Being able to see that is an opportunity for them to model that same behavior, because medicine is more than just a practice. That's a big part of it. That's why we have medical school and training. However, the real life part of medicine involves so much more. And so the opportunity to see that in action, I think, is valuable. And I would like to believe that the students who have an opportunity to shadow myself and other physicians working in rural communities is part of that, you know, it's like lighting that fire for them deciding to serve in outside of an urban community, so to speak.
Yeah. When you look at a community and you think of the impact of healthcare, it goes far beyond healthy community members. And having homegrown healthcare providers is so important. That is where the community finds trust, is when they know someone. And in knowing that family, or knowing that that doctor or healthcare professional has come from a rural community, from my understanding, there's so much more of a trust, and there is so many benefits and impacts to that community as well.
And I think that, you know, as I mentioned, you know, probably half of the people that serve are going to actually originate from that community. But the other half, like myself, are not from the areas where they serve, but just have a real interest in really becoming a part of the community. And so it's important for people to know that, you know, when they choose to go to a rural community, then they can also learn the community, and they're very welcoming. I mean, when I think about the obstetric statistics in terms of OBGYNs, you know, only 89 counties have an OBGYN. Now, granted, we do have 159 counties, so that's pretty much, you know, almost half. But the thing is, in my vision, would be for every county or for that distribution to be where, you know, everybody could access an OBGYN within 30 minutes of where they live. And so that may mean that we don't have one in every single county, but a lot of the counties are close. And so that is not an impossible thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so if we could develop the roadmap to look like that, where you can see an OBGYN within 30 minutes of where you live and people are not driving an hour or 2 hours to get, you know, women's health care. But that's the kind of thing that I think Mercer and a lot of our medical schools actually in the state are really working on contributing to. You know, a lot of the schools, Morehouse and MCG and our Augusta University now, and, you know, even PCOM, a lot of our schools are really looking to help to move the needle in that direction. And it really is a shared vision and a joint interest for us to be able to help our communities do better and have better outcomes. And it will take that kind of partnership and collaboration to really move things forward. And so I'm really happy that Mercer is charging ahead with that and really making headway on, you know, in terms of scholarships and training and opportunities. So I think things are moving in the right direction. It's slow and it takes a while.
It does.
But we're moving in the right direction.
And I agree. I think Mercer is implementing the right strategies to do so. And like you said, not just, you know, healthcare providers that are from communities and stay there, but also those who go to Mercer and may be supporting a different community than they're from or coming from a different area. But their commitment to those areas, I think, really bring that support and care that those rural communities need as well. That was a great point. But yes, Mercer is doing an amazing job with their strategies and their programs to support healthcare in rural communities. And I think the numbers are showing it. They are, like you said, slow, but it's there with 80% in Georgia and 60% in rural communities. That is amazing.
And that's what we call being mission-minded. That's what it's all about.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, so we are going to take a left turn into literacy a bit. Well, I guess not a left turn because the intersection is so, so strong. But I wanted to just talk about the literacy board and the connection that you met sitting on the board and just that story of how literacy and healthcare began to intersect for you. Can you share that with me?
Thank you. Absolutely. I love the opportunity to share this because, you know, in training, I don't know that I thought about literacy the way that I do now. And I do have two children, 18 now and 14. And so I have been a part of, you know, literacy in terms of teaching my children how to read and get through school. But, you know, something interesting happened when I joined the faculty at Mercer and then shortly thereafter, Governor Deal at the time appointed me to serve on the board. It was an inaugural board in honor of his wife, Sandra Dunnigan Deal, to really help promote literacy in the state. And so I thought, this is good, you know, medicine over here, literacy over here, but they're not separate. And so being able to serve on the board and really be a part of the conversation for how we integrate literacy into a lifestyle and the fact that, you know, although it is important for our students to be proficient in reading by third grade, that whole process starts so much earlier. So now I'm starting to kind of preach, if I could use that word, you know, pre-birth, which is me, you know, reading to kids in third trimester. So while babies are still in the womb, and then, you know, really focusing on the next milestone will be age 3, and then also at third grade. And so, you know, I've went to a conference recently and this number stuck out in my mind that 90% of the brain development happens, you know, before kindergarten. So there's so much that we can do and should do to help learning and literacy early. It's not something that we kind of wait for the teachers to do when they show up, right? I mean, it's something that needs to happen in the community, happens in the home. And so I attended the first conference for the Early Language and Literacy Center. And I kind of sat in the back of the room because I was kind of multitasking, and sat beside an amazing woman, Dr. Sarah Hawthorne, who actually has now become a mentor slash godmother. And so we kind of just bonded. She actually knew Dr. Jean Sumner, who's the dean of our medical school at Mercer. And we just made an instant connection. We spent the rest of the conference kind of sitting beside each other, and we came up with a grant opportunity idea that we wanted to apply for in Twiggs County, which is where she lived and grew up. And so after the conference, I actually went to or came to a meeting. I'm in actually in Twiggs County today to help the grant writing process. And I strongly encourage that they include their local physician in this effort. And everyone at the table looked at me and said, "We don't have a physician." And I was like, "What do you mean you don't have a physician here?" There was no physician in Twiggs County, not on record.
How far was the closest physician?
Do you know? So the closest, there are a couple cities that are close by. So Macon would be 30 minutes. Milledgeville would be probably about 40 minutes. And Dublin would be probably about 40 minutes. And so that's where the nearest physician and or hospital would be, so to speak. And so I thought that was interesting. And so at the time, I was actually onboarding with Community Healthcare Systems, and I approached our CEO, Ms. Carla Belcher, about the opportunity to work not only in Jones, which is where I was planning on being primarily, but could I also work in the Twiggs County office? And she said, sure. I mean, I thought to myself, you know, how interesting that that conversation of meeting Dr. Hawthorne led to the grant opportunity, which led to my involvement in the grant project, which led to me asking to be able to work here. And so, you know, I credit Dr. Hawthorne all the time for my immersion into Twiggs County. But literacy truly is what brought me to serve here in a medical capacity. And so it's interesting looking back on how that trajectory has changed things. So my involvement in the board, involvement in activities here in our community, and just involvement in literacy and learning in general, how that has been become intertwined into my medical practice. So conversations with my moms and my grandmas, you know, what book are you reading? Or do you and your child or your grandchild have a library card? You know, are you all reading together? Are you spending 20 minutes a day reading together? So all of that is now infused into my medical practice, which is really kind of a public health thing, I guess, or a population health thing. But totally. I really love that that has evolved in that way. And now I get to encourage my students, whether that they are medical students, nurse practitioner students, you know, undergraduates, about the importance of interweaving literacy into their medical practice. Because it helps, you know, health literacy is key for people to feel comfortable navigating the healthcare space, understanding information they read online, how they interact with their own health. That's all related. And so it really, I am consider myself very fortunate to have had those things happen in that way to help transition and evolve, help things evolve the way that they have.
Yeah. I mean, my brain is kind of going in so many directions. There's so many supports that having some kind of literacy support with your doctor's office, if not there, where else? You know, we know that parents are taking their babies to doctor's appointments and those small conversations. If not there, then, you know, where else is it happening? I know from my experience as a new mom, whenever I went to go see the pediatrician, I had a million questions. That was my trusted resource. And, to hear the, I think it's the three months, 3 years. And of course we know the third grade impacts on literacy. A mom who doesn't know that reading to her unborn baby at 3 months is important. Where else is she going to get that information?
And so we really have a unique opportunity to promote literacy as a part of everything else that we do. It's not like a separate thing. And I think that's the light bulb moment for me. And so, and that can look very different. So, you know, my oldest is a boy, and so he may not want to read a book, but we can read car magazines, right? So even just sharing that, you know, if you're driving down the highway, let's read the billboards, Absolutely. Or, you know, any number of things to that degree is really how that works. You know, when you go to the grocery store, you know, looking at the different items, you know, the different tomatoes, the shapes, and, you know, the different names and where they're from. And just there's so many opportunities to really promote literacy and learning that happen early. And so I think as a community, we have a responsibility to embrace that.
Absolutely.
And it's never too early. And it's everybody's responsibility, right? To be a part of that process. And if we do that, then when they do transition to school, per se, in the formal sense, they're going to have a different experience if they're coming in with that advantage. And I think that we need to do everything we can to give our children that advantage. And all of our healthcare professionals, because they're a trusted source. Right. And so when you say you really should consider this, or I think you should do this, that gets received differently. And okay. So we should absolutely use that scope of influence to promote literacy and interweave it into everything that we do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you mentioned talking to students about those impacts and those conversations. You yourself are having those conversations with parents, families, and caregivers. Are there any other maybe strategies or any other programs or anything like that that you guys are currently doing in Greater Jeffersonville that supports literacy and healthcare?
So I think that, you know, there's a program that is called The Basics. It is a kind of a strategy for how we engage the community that's becoming more popular. Columbus was actually the first Georgia community to adopt the principles and the basics. And then since then, the Deal Center has been encouraging and supporting additional communities to engage similar programs. But also, there are a lot of other existing programs that are really already entrenched in Georgia's system. There's the Get Reading Georgia campaign. That is very active. There's Read to Me Baby. I mean, there are actually a lot of things that are actually going on that are designed to help that. I think that what we can work on is making sure that more people are aware of those things, mm-hmm. and they have access to those resources. And we are repetitively promoting and reinforcing utilization of those resources. And so I want to be clear that we are not really starting from scratch, but we do have a lot of things. The infrastructure is here, and we just have room for improvement in how we promote that in every opportunity that we have. So it should not be that, you know, if you live on, you know, on the west side or the east side or, you know, north or south, that it's different. What we're trying to get to is that, I'm going to use the term literacy equity, which, you know, we think about health equity all the time, but, you know, literacy equity, what does that look like? And meaning, regardless of what your zip code is, do you know that these four things are available and accessible to you? And I think that's kind of our next level in terms of the work that we need to do is all available tools. Does everyone have access to that? And so that will become literacy equity, in my opinion.
What I hear is that the programs are there. They work. You have, they've been proven to work, but making sure that everyone has access to them through, like you said, literacy equity is kind of where the push is and needs to be. We're not starting over. The programs are here. They work. And it's about making sure that there's equity and that everybody knows that they're available and that all healthcare providers, regardless of where we're located, have these supports and they're providing these supports to patients. Did I get that right?
You got it right. You summed it up perfectly. Yes.
Awesome. So Get Ready and Read to Me Baby. I believe those are programs that help, that support families in. So you go to your physician, you'll go to your checkup, and they will provide you with books and with reading materials.
And a lot of it uses our current technology. So a lot of these are apps that we can be accessed through our mobile phone. But also, too, I want to mention one thing that sometimes can be a challenge is, you know, if we have parents, grandparents who have struggled with literacy, then it may be hard for them to engage their children and grandchildren. And so really our community needs to be sensitive to how we really support people who are concerned that they can't do a good job of that and help them do that. And that's why really intersecting with, for example, our public libraries and the resources they offer both in the facility plus online is really important. And then also our technical colleges, they do have a lot of programs to support. And so if we identify, for example, through whatever community outreach that there is a mom who really wants to do something different to help her own literacy, then really as a community, we need to have, you know, make sure there's no stigma for people reaching out for help. And then how do we support that, whatever their goals may be? And they may want to get a GED, or they may want to finish a technical degree, or they may want to do something else that they, you know, have always wanted to do, but not sure how to do that. I had a patient this week who expressed an interest in nursing, but said she just wasn't really sure how to get into that. And so again, I think literacy is should be focused dually, not just on the actual, the child or the children in the home, but making sure that the community that supports them is confident that they can do a good job of that. Because we don't want someone who's struggling with reading to then just not even bother to help their child. And so we kind of have a dual responsibility to how we wrap around the family and give them what they need and make sure we have a space where if people are uncomfortable and they have struggle, then they can say that. And we say, oh, okay, if that's what it is, then let's do this. Or if not that, then do something else. And so really just, you know, as we're doing with mental health, changing the stigma around that, I think when it comes to literacy, we have to tackle that as well very aggressively with the community that will be responsible for getting those kids ready and making sure that all that brain development that happens before kindergarten really, we've got to address that part too.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, more than just making sure that the parents are equipped to support the kids, but also being a safe space for parents as well, and supporting their capacity and building their capacity to be the best versions of themselves and then be able to support their children in the best way.
Absolutely.
Super, super, super impactful. And it takes the whole community. It really does. It really does. And you know, I actually, when you mentioned a safe space, I immediately thought, you know, yes, absolutely. We have to have different ways to support children, right? We need to not only tell the parents that they need to read to their kids, but like you said, have the apps and have different programs that they can go to and attend, whether it's at the library or I know some, a lot of technical colleges, as you mentioned, or other colleges will have programs as well in their early education that'll support children. But more than just supporting the children in one way, but supporting those parents as well so that they can do their best to support their children. I got to tell you that was one that when you said, I was like, why didn't I think of that? But it is really so important to empower and build that capacity of our parents so that they can best serve and grow their children as well. So thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate you for that so much. So it sounds like that foundation is there. You all are doing an amazing job through Mercer, through supporting the patients in rural communities in Gray and Jeffersonville. So thank you. Thank you. We're just super grateful for those impacts on rural communities. If there was any way that you think it could be better? And I think you shared a little bit about just the literacy equity. Would that be your, if it could be better, we would have more equity, would that be your kind of charge?
Well, I think that I want to answer that by actually referencing and highlighting the legacy of former First Lady Sandra Dunningham Deal. she really embodied what literacy efforts should look like. She went to every single county in the state and read to children. And I think that, I don't know that anyone else has done that on record, and that was her passion. She was a teacher, a graduate of Georgia College, but, and that's why, the center is named after her. You know, her husband did that in her honor. But I really think that that is the model that she set up, and that is, we need to go out literally, you know how we talk about go tell it on the mountain, but we really need to go out and really touch every single community, every county. And there may be different ways to do that. So she went and she read to children, but what if everybody kind of did their own version of, I'm going to take care of these five counties, or I'm going to take care of these three, or I'm going to do this. But that's the kind of impact that I am. I received that example, and I really want to encourage us all to model that same thing. And her legacy about literacy will live on, because that is a pretty, very ambitious task that she completed. And so I think everything that we do should really be, how ambitious can we be in our efforts to touch every county and to make sure that what the children in that county have access to is not determined by whether or not they're in the corner of the state or in the middle of the state, or if they have a population of, 5,000 versus 50,000. That's the goal. And so I really want to acknowledge her contribution and the effort that she put into really modeling that for us. And so we're fortunate to have that. That's homegrown all the way. And so that's that statement. And the last thing that I'll say, I'll end with a quote that's become one of my new favorite quotes, which is, change happens at the speed of trust. And so as we work on what we do in the literacy space and literacy equity, which is our new word now, we have to build relationships within our community. We have to work together with our families, with our parents, with our grandparents, aunties, uncles, the electrician, the neighbor, the hairdresser, the barber. Everybody really is a part of the literacy movement, and it's not a separate thing. It really is a lifestyle that we are encouraging, that everyone adopt that literacy lifestyle.
My next question, and I think you kind of grabbed it, if there's one thing you'd like listeners to take away from this podcast and understanding the intersection of literacy and healthcare, what would it be? And something tells me it would be just that change happens at the speed of trust.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we can all do that. And keeping in mind that, we don't always get it right the first time. Mm-hmm. But there's an opportunity to repair those relationships that may not be working well, so we can do better. And so my other new word is learning how to pivot when things change and adjust accordingly. And one thing that we are all now familiar with in the post-pandemic world is learning how to pivot and adjust. And I think that literacy will live if we learn to do that well, and we adapt with our communities and we adapt with our circumstances. And so my takeaway would be that just literacy become a lifestyle and be ingrained in everything that we do. Asking your friends, what book are you reading? Or, you meet a kid somewhere, have you read your 20 minutes today? Just like how we say, have you brushed your teeth? Like, really, literacy should be at that same level. Have you done your 20 minutes of exercise? Like, elevating it to that level of being an essential thing that we do every day.
Part of those wellness, just, hey, did you brush your teeth? I tell my kid, did you brush your teeth? What else? Did you brush your teeth? Did you walk somewhere? Did you exercise?
Did you eat your veggies?
Right. But those can come like so easy in conversation, mm-hmm, with our children and with even like our friends, like, hey, have you been working out? But how about, hey, have you read anything lately?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. So it's not super, super hard. We just have to be intentional, mm-hmm, and just changing our perspective or mindset, because we have a goal in mind. What's our goal? Reading proficiency. And I will tell you, that I figured it out that if, you know how to read, then you can, pursue your education, then you can get employment, and then you can get insurance with benefits, and then you can kind of really take care of your health. And so really, literacy is that foundation to even really helping health outcomes. I mean, we can't ignore it. It's a social determinant, right? And so it's all connected.
It is. I was speaking with someone in the medical industry who shared with me that there was a patient who there was an error that happened, and they were just so sleepy from taking, I think it was a diabetes medication, but because they could not read and they did not read the bottle of medication, it impacted their health.
So it can be helpful or harmful. And so, I think our takeaway is going to be, are you living the literacy lifestyle? And do your friends know it? Like, you can do it. But even as adults, are we modeling that behavior? I tell my moms all the time, if your child doesn't see you eating an apple, they won't eat an apple. They model your behavior. You can say eat an apple, but if you eat an apple, they probably will eat the apple. So similarly, you should have they should see you with a book in your hand at some point. And if they do see that, then chances are, and I've seen that even with my youngest, my daughter now, I see her like getting books and reading, and I'm just observing her, and it makes me smile when I see her saying, when she asks, can we go so I can get a new book? And I think, yeah, we can go. That's great. Mm-hmm. But you have to model that behavior. And so as much as we talk it, we have to do it so they can see it, and then they can replicate it.
I don't know if you've seen the trend on social media, but moms are sharing their hack on how you get kids to try new food. And the first thing you do is you get an adult plate, a fancy plate, you put it on there and you pretend like you're going to eat it.
Right. Because that's exactly what they do. They model the behavior. And so our kids or friends or family should see us reading a book. Absolutely. And I think that is part of how we make literacy a lifestyle.
Absolutely. I was finishing my undergrad. My daughter was, I want to say, kindergarten. And I would come home from work and we'd do dinner. And then I'd have my notebooks, my books, and I'd just be doing homework. And I had to go ahead and get her own notebook. And you know what? It was before kindergarten. She must have been 2 or 3 because she would fill out the notebook. And she'd write on each line with just squiggles and just circles everywhere. And as I was continuing to finish, now she's in kindergarten, and she would go and get one of her books and she would just copy the pages of the book on the notebook because she was, like you said, she was imitating what I was doing. I was taking notes, but in her mind, she's like, she's writing words out of this book. I am going to write words out of this book as well. So yes, absolutely. When we model those behaviors for our children, and they follow suit, and it gets them on the right trajectory to success.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Callens, thank you so much for joining us. If there's anything else that you'd like to share, any announcements or anything like that, please do so. Again, y'all, this is Kat with Field Notes, and we are super, super grateful to have Dr. Callens here with us today, sharing about that intersection between literacy and healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. I love the opportunity to share some stories with you about the journey to medicine and just how literacy has become ingrained in both my practice and also my ability to teach and mentor our future generation of healthcare professionals. So thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you. And absolutely. Thank you. And it's been so great just talking with you. All right, listeners, until next time. And remember, a better future for Georgia starts with education.
Thank you for listening to Field Notes, a podcast hosted by the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. We hope you gained some insight and new information from your trusted source for impacting Georgia's educational system and workforce outcomes. And for more information, visit gpee.org. And with the simple click to subscribe, we'll invite you back to hear more, because a better future for Georgia begins with education.